Hello, this is Hillel Tecton speaking in the fifth podcast of the series. Today I want to discuss, in relation to the crisis which we've been talking about, the question of decline. We began by talking about the question of austerity. And the argument on austerity was that austerity was a deliberate policy. It did not flow automatically from overexpenditure, as the government in Britain, Germany, United States, or wherever has tended to argue. Although, of course, the United States is not implementing officially a policy of austerity. Nonetheless, that is the effect of the policy that they are going through, even if a lesser form of it than in Europe. So the question is, why is it that they are pursuing this policy in a deeper sense than the one I argued, which was to say that they needed it in order to control the working class, in order to effectively control the system? So why is it that they've lost control then? What has happened? The present crisis is deeper and more extensive, in fact, than the Great Depression. That is because it is a global depression. It is extensive, and the drop in production in many countries has been greater than it was during the Great Depression. That wasn't true of the United States, but the United States went in for salvage, effectively, and saw to it that its banks were propped up and dealt with in a way that the other countries haven't done. However, quite apart from that, what I've just said is that the present crisis is more profound than the last one in the 30s. And the question that I'm asking is, what is the deeper reason why, under conditions where unemployment is in fact rising, where there's extensive unemployment, why is it that they still feel it necessary to introduce a policy of austerity? And we argued that the reason was they were caught, that they had really no alternative if they were not to go the other road, which was to make a series of concessions, which ultimately they would not be able to control the result of the concessions. Now, what that implies is that the ruling class has lost control of the system itself. Now, that's no new discovery. But let us look at what the form of capitalism is which ensures that control. In the first instance, it involves the existence of the reserve army of labor. A reserve army of labor is not just unemployment. The mass of unemployed includes a large number who are not employed at all, who don't go in and out, in other words, of work. That's again true today. The reserve army of labor is composed of people who lose their jobs and then find new jobs and go on doing so over their lifetime. They may, of course, drop out for a time and then come back and stay in the reserve army of labor or not. The essential point is there is this pressure of unemployed workers who compete with other workers in order to get the jobs and who consequently accept both lower wages and inferior conditions compared to what it would be like and has been like in the past, where they had full employment. Now, in part, the reason why we don't have the same kind of reserve army of labor does not have to do with simple numbers. It has to do with the fact that under pressure of democratic forms or semi-democratic forms, governments have been compelled to introduce a welfare state. Now again, that is very limited in the United States, although it exists up to a point. But it is quite extensive in Europe, nowhere near extensive compared to what is needed. Nonetheless, it is quite extensive. And workers today, when they lose their jobs, do not end up in the same way as they did in the 19th century, having to starve, or at least beg, borrow, or whatever, in order to survive, if they survive. So, what one has, in other words, is a situation for workers that they don't have to fear what they did in the period before the Second World War, effectively. Now, we know that part of austerity is very much the question of cutting welfare benefits, because it is argued that workers are skiving, that's to say, they're simply not telling the truth when they say they can't get a job, or that they have savings or don't have savings or whatever, or whether they can work or can't work and so forth. Consequently, they have to have, as in Britain, a privatized arm of the state which checks whether workers can work and does its best to ensure that they are proven to be able to work, and the reason they're not working, it is then often argued, is simply that they don't want to work, they're just lazy. Well, of course, the apparatus amounts to a modern apparatus of force, a modern apparatus of economic force to ensure that as few people as possible do receive these benefits. Now, that's very much part, a central part, of the austerity program that we see. Now, the point that I'm making here is that this is really a reflection of the fact that capitalism had to make the concession to have welfare benefits to effectively reduce the potency of the reserve army of labor, or in fact one can argue that we don't have a real reserve army of labor as it used to exist. And the consequence of that is that the working class isn't under the same control that it has been in classic capitalism, and that to have an effective, efficient capitalism, one has to have a truly functioning reserve army of labor, not one which is effectively limping, to play around with metaphors. So, one of the crucial bases, therefore, of control under capitalism is limited, and indeed one could argue it is broken, because it is almost certainly impossible to restore the reserve army of labor to the form that it existed before the Second World War. However, it does look like sections of the capital class want to do that because they realize that is crucial to the maintenance of capitalism itself. Now, if this is the case, one has to say that capitalism itself is in trouble, because reserve army of labor is crucial to its functioning. It's not simply that it is crucial to its functioning as we watch it today. Theoretically, if we look at the way it's supposed to function, ought to function, does in fact function over hundreds of years or whatever, then capitalism needs a healthy reserve army of labor. The fact that it doesn't isn't just a technicality, or isn't a temporary breakdown. it was gradually changed and gradually effectively removed to be replaced by something which is much less than a reserve army of labor. Why I brought this out is to discuss the question of decline, and what I've been saying here is that capitalism in decline loses crucial aspects which buttress it, which underlie it, which are essential to its functioning. Or we can put it another way, in a dialectical way, we can say that in decline, a system in decline finds that the mediations which ensure that its contradictions, or the poles of its contradictions, are able to interact, the mediations which are needed for that are more difficult to find, or malfunction to a greater degree, or perhaps sometimes don't even exist, in which case, of course, we get a crisis. But that is increasingly the case. It's increasingly the case that it's more and more difficult to deal with crises. It's more and more difficult to deal with the problems of capital as capital, or capitalism as capitalism. That is what is meant by decline of capitalism. What is not meant by a decline of capitalism is simply the argument that it is the case that total production is going down, productivity is going down, or other absolute statistics. That is not the argument that I'm going to produce, nor do I think it is a real argument. The question isn't one of an absolute decline that clearly isn't taking place, although there are aspects, of course, and there are always aspects of total decline existing in a system which is in decline, but the overall system continues to raise productivity. That is in the nature of capitalism. That is the justification, as it were, of capitalism itself, and that continues to go on. So, the point I've just made is by illustrating the question of decline with austerity, the basis of it, to point out that one of the pillars of capitalism, reserve army of labor, is effectively undermined. The second pillar of capitalism is commodity fetishism. That's to say that the controls within capitalism itself show itself through sale and purchase, through the commodity, through exchange, and that the exchange operates by itself. If you want, you can relate that to Adam Smith's Hidden Hand, which Stiglitz laughs at and says the problem with the hidden hand is not a theoretical one, it simply doesn't exist. Well, one could say that too, depending on what one means by hidden hand. However, what one does have under capitalism is the form of a product being one of exchange value, value in exchange, which takes the superficial form of price. Now, and the point being there that the interrelationships within capitalism are interrelationships between exchange values, which appear to operate by themselves, and then give the direction to the economy as a whole, standing above mankind, it would appear. The market, in other words, rules, and the market appears to be a technical function of the system. It doesn't appear to be something which is man-made and driven by humanity. It doesn't appear to be human, in other words. But of course, it is human. The market is the functioning of human beings in their relationships within the division of labor within society, in their class relationships of capital and labor, the sale of labor power itself, which is turning human acts into what appears to be a technical form, a technical economic form, the sale of labor power, which then stands above the human being. The human being has to sell the labor power in order to exist, in order to function, in order to feed, clothe, and house themselves and their families. So, that is the second form of control, the second crucial aspect of capitalism, which is also undermined. It is undermined because, at the most basic level, workers are able to see that they are indeed exploited, that they have to sell their labor power, that the labor power is used, their labor then is used to create the value, which is turned into profit, and a small part going to them as wages, which is turned into profit, which in turn adds to capital, and therefore permits the basis of the system, capital functioning as self-expanding value. So, self-expanding value, which appears to be a force of nature standing above mankind, is the central basis of capitalism itself. Self-expanding value. That does act by itself, but of course it is human beings acting within a particular system, within particular forms which they have created. But precisely because it is forms which stand above mankind, above humanity, that the working class has to understand it, not simply accept it, because in the first instance, standing above humanity, people tend to accept it. However, once it's clear what is happening, and it is clear today, it's clear to anybody who wants to read on the subject, and not just read orthodox economics, which does its best to obscure reality, which is precisely set up in order to ensure that the market appears eternal and a wonder to behold indeed. A more perfect way of running the economy, according to them, could not really exist. But once one understands that that is not the case, ideologically, it becomes hard for the capitalist class to defend itself. Now, of course, precisely because capital does function, it is self-expanding value. It does operate. Most people accept it as it exists, even if they don't understand exactly what is going on. However, we've had several centuries and sufficient time, not only for an exploration as to what is going on in the works of the left, in the works of Marxists, and not just Marxists, in fact, so that the ideology, to a large degree, is shot through. However much the attempt has been made to restore the ideology of commodity fusion, it hasn't really succeeded. It is only partially in control. And therefore, the ideology itself is unstable, and dubious. It has gone through various forms, of course, over time, but it remains the case that it is not trusted and it is not believed to a very large degree. Of course, the result of a situation where we have the capitalist as the embodiment of the self-expanding value, who takes the profits, who has the control, and has the wealth and the high standard of living, and the worker who is the opposite, who has a low standard of living relatively, and who has to accept the fact that he or she is controlled. Of course, as long as that is the case, it's very hard to justify. Still more so when one has the development of working class organizations arguing that it is unjustifiable, when there are many pamphlets, books, speeches arguing that. However much the media does its best to restore, as it were, the situation to the 19th century, it cannot do so. So ideologically, it doesn't work. Capitalism, in that sense, is also in trouble. And it's not something that can be restored. So the ideology of capitalism, which is commodity fetishism, it's not religion or whatever. It is commodity fetishism. It's not religion, it's not nationalism, although both of them have tended to support capitalism. It is above all commodity fetishism. If the market is not accepted, the system is in trouble. Clearly, if one has a downturn as today, where capitalism looks broken, and indeed is broken, people must further question whether they have to go on with a system of fantastic inequality, a system which on the one hand proclaims democracy, that we vote for our leaders, on the other hand, it enforces a dictatorship over workers in the factory, in the institutions, in the public sector. So, people, the question of how long will the system continue is posed, and has been posed in the past. Of course, the Russian Revolution overthrew capitalism. Unfortunately, it turned into Stalinism, which was then used as a stick to beat the left, and indeed as proof that capitalism is superior. It is indeed true that Stalinism was inefficient and remained inefficient to the end. That is, of course, the case. Now, second or third aspect of the present crisis to which we can refer is the way in which capital is not functioning as capital. In other words, what is actually happening is that an increasing quantity of money has had to be saved in the banks, most particularly in the banks, so that one has something like $27 trillion being held by one bank, Bank of New York Mellon, and various other international banks hold further trillions. In fact, one looks at the figures, you see an enormous flood of money which is not being turned into capital. So that one of the most important aspects of this crisis is the way in which investment is not taking place. We do not have self-expanding value, instead of which to a considerable degree, businesses and rich individuals hold money. Money is not capital in itself. Money is money. It is the universal equivalent, but in itself it is not capital, unless it is invested in order to obtain profits, and it does obtain the profits indeed, turning into self-expanding value. But that is not happening to the degree that would have been expected. This is probably the first time that such huge sums of money are simply lying idle. That is a crucial aspect of this crisis, where it differs from previous crises. Not in the way money is not being invested, but the enormous amount of it that's not being invested and its generalized form, because it's not just in the United States that that is the case. There is an overall refusal to reinvest. One political group has talked of it as a strike by the capitalist class. This issue hasn't just arisen with the crisis itself. An article in the Financial Times on Thursday tries to discuss this very question and comes up by saying that he doesn't know what the answer is, that there are a number of different theories. One theory being put forward is that of Krugman, who argues this is the effect of monopoly. Well, that might well be an additional aspect of it. Anyway, the point is that this refusal to invest in the old way precedes the crisis itself, the immediate crisis, the one of 2007. That in fact there has been a wall of money which doesn't know where it can go. That itself shows one that there is a crisis, and that the crisis is not just a temporary crisis, but it is a reflection of the problems of capital, where capital cannot be capital, and that part of the reason why this is the case is precisely the decline of capitalism to a point where the capitalist class is afraid to reflate, because that is what it would be required, that it must turn to finance capital, which is a crucial aspect of the decline of capitalism, a wasteful, short-termist form, finance capital, in order to survive, rather than invest and expand and effectively end the reserve army of labor, have full employment. They won't do that because they're afraid they will be overthrown. They will simply not do that. But the reverse then happens. They end up not being capitalist themselves. Capital cannot be capital. So, I've been discussing the question of decline, and what I've said here is that we have a number of aspects which show the decline. I've gone through just effectively three aspects, but the underlying basis of it, the ultimate underlying basis of it, rests in the increasing socialization of industry and of labor. That's to say, the form of industry itself is increasingly integrated. And it necessarily turns to forms which are integrated, which are more social. Even if at the same time we have a movement to try and undo that, turn it back, or prevent it. Nonetheless, we see two special aspects. One is the increasing role of government. It's true, as I said, nationalized forms have been privatized. Nonetheless, even the privatized forms, like in the utilities, usually have social forms which control the prices or have a tremendous influence on prices. They usually have forms where government is involved and continues to be involved. We know that you have extensive use of subsidies, guarantees, and direct investment by governments as well. Now, one can spend a long time talking about the different aspects and the conflicts which go on. Nonetheless, it's clear that this form, in effect, cannot be undone, however much you have a section of the capitalist class which wants to go to a situation where there's simply a very small government, a very small administration. In fact, it isn't going that way and won't go that way. The second aspect of this is the increasing centralization and concentration within the economy itself. Now, although there are counter-tendencies, it remains the case that what one has is economies which are effectively dominated by very large firms, with a mass of small firms around it, which are usually used as proof that the monopolies don't exist or not important. But of course, that is not true. It is rather the other way around, that the small firms are dependent on the large firms. So, what we have is increasing degree of socialization. And it is this which, of course, again indicates that the form of capital, which is a large number of competing capitals, which in turn, because our competing raise productivity, that this form no longer exists. That the rise in productivity, which was an essential basis of capitalism and of its justification, is limited, and is more limited than what the alternative would be, let's say a socialist planned society, which would plan to introduce whatever new forms are required, as they are required, and forms which are closer to what are needed as opposed to what is actually produced. So, what I've now said is also that one of the aspects of decline is that there is no absolute decline, but relative to what is possible, a planned society controlled from below is possible, and it would have higher levels of productivity and produce the goods which people need rather than what are produced simply for profit. So, I've been through a number of the forms. I haven't been through all the forms of decline, but I've been through a number of the forms, and I've tried to relate them to the present crisis. Thank you.